funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do law students really need to learn in order to actually find jobs as attorneys after they finish school? And how can they be sure all the money they're spending on their education is a good investment? The job market for lawyers in America has shrunk significantly over the past several years, so that as of 2011, just over half of law students found a job as a lawyer within 9 months of graduation. And now initial law school applications have begun to fall as well. It might seem a poor climate in which to open a new law school, but the faculty and administrators of UNT's Dallas College of Law, which will open the doors to its first class of students this fall, say that changes in the industry make this an ideal time to rethink the way would-be attorneys are educated, which is what they intend to do. The Honorable Royal Ferguson is retired U.S. District Judge and Dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law, and Professor Ellen S. Pryor is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs there. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
What do you see as the purpose of law school?
The purpose is to educate people to go practice law. That's the purpose. It's very important that we have lawyers in our society because lawyers make the law work, and we are a nation of laws. And so if the law works, then society benefits, and we can maintain our freedom and our democracy. That may seem like a big overall kind of aspect to it, but we think the law is very important. And therefore, lawyers are very important. And the purpose of our law school is to graduate people who can be good lawyers and can serve their communities and who are not burdened by excessive debt.
This new law school has been several years in the making. Talk about the thinking behind locating it in downtown Dallas specifically.
I will continue to answer some of these questions, okay, but Ellen's going to jump in any minute now. I think in the beginning, the purpose of creating the UNT Dallas College of Law was the fact that this metropolitan area of 7 or 8 million people, had no public law school. And in fact, we were the largest metropolitan area in the United States that had no public law school. So the legislature said, let's create a public law school. We'll put it in downtown Dallas, and we will address that issue. Of course, then, before we knew it, Texas A&M had taken the Texas Wesleyan Law School and made it its own. So now we have two public law schools in this region when we only anticipated we would have ours. But still, we're going to be in different space. We're going to be in a different place. And I think we're going to have different missions. So I believe there's still a good argument to be made for having a public law school in downtown Dallas, serving the Dallas region as the A&M school continues to serve the Fort Worth region.
And Chris, I'll just add that the location of the UNT Dallas College of Law in downtown was also a part of the UNT system's continuing mission to serve the North Texas region generally. So we all, those of us who grew up in Dallas, think of UNT as being up in Denton, but UNT also opened a UNT Dallas campus in the southern part of the southern sector of the city, down off Camp Wisdom Boulevard. That's a four-year campus with a mission of excellence and expanding access to four-year education in the southern sector. So I think back then, the planning was that there would be a graduate school components to that. So it's also part of a growth of the system serving our region.
And, of course, there are a lot of lawyers working in downtown Dallas. How does their presence in proximity to the school sort of make a difference for the climate for students and the things that they're able to be exposed to as they're studying?
Well, we want to make it that just an enormous asset for our students and for the community that we create down there. We see it both as the law community and the civic community being something we bring into the school and have our students' education be involved in participation in the community and in pro bono activities and externships throughout the community. And then we also see that our mission and goal will be include a kind of civic education space in the downtown area that relates to legal education. And this may be a year or so down the road, but we envision ourselves as being able to be a helpful partner in dialogue about legal and civic-related issues in our urban space. So we can provide and hope to provide not just a JD education, but law-related education for healthcare professionals, for educators, et cetera.
Also, Chris, not only are there a couple of thousand really fine lawyers in the downtown area, all the courts are in the downtown area. We are within 10 or 12 blocks of the federal courts and the state courts. This is a great opportunity for our young people just to walk down the street, observe what's going on. It will open up externship for them with these wonderful judges. We are really in a place where there's an enormous amount of legal activity and court activity, which will enrich our kids, our young people, a great deal.
One of the things that you have stressed is that you want to focus on practice-related competencies. What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, Chris, starting about 20 years ago, the ABA began to really focus on the fact that law schools needed to be more, to educate students more in relation to practice skills, negotiating, interviewing, et cetera, and not just on legal reasoning and the doctrinal method in law schools. So competencies is a way of talking about skills, but instead talking about skills and conveying that we want people to have a certain level of proficiency in this. So you could say that instead of just having classes on skills, we want to have classes that include a number of abilities, aptitudes, and skills, and that we want ways to denote that people have achieved proficiency in them. It sounds maybe buzzwordy, but it's a word that more and more law schools are beginning to use and medical professional schools are beginning to use because we want to denote not just that we're looking at skills and not just knowledge, but we're also trying to come up with ways of measuring aptitude and proficiency in achieving those. So that's what they are.
Also, Chris, you might find it interesting to know that this month, the American Bar Association, which accredits law schools, came up with report and recommendations from a task force on the future of legal education. And in regard to that issue you just talked about, competency-related training, one of their primary recommendations was this. It said, a given law school can have multiple purposes, but the core purpose common to all law schools is to prepare individuals to provide legal and related services in a professionally responsible fashion. This elementary fact is often minimized. The calls for more attention to skills training and the development of practice-related competencies have been heard, and many law schools have expanded practice preparation opportunities for students. Yet, there is a need to do much more. The balance between doctrinal instruction and focused preparation for the delivery of legal services needs to shift further toward developing the competencies and professionalism required of people who will deliver services to clients, close quote. Basically, the American Bar Association, the Lawyers of America, are saying, law schools, you must do more toward competency-based training. The great thing about our law school is we're starting fresh, and that's going to be our concentration. And because we have Ellen, who is so seeped in this area of academics, we are really going to be able to direct our instruction in this area. And this is exactly what the Lawyers of America are asking for law schools. And because we're starting fresh, that can be our focus from the beginning.
And Chris, one more thing. I think it'd be easier to say we are focusing on making practice-ready lawyers. And we've not wanted to say that, although a number of it sometimes seeps into the conversation. But we're not sure that we can say a law school can graduate a student who's completely practice ready. I mean, that's kind of the goal, or that may be the overall goal, but a way of talking about practice-related competencies conveys that there's a basket of things.
Well, let's talk about that, because I guess historically you might graduate at the top of your class, but in terms of hitting the ground running, maybe you don't know the basic sort of steps to take to file something. You understand all the concepts behind it, but you don't know where to go in the courthouse to take care of things. Is that sort of the issue?
That's part of the issue. I think even more, maybe even more broadly, though, let's just think about, let's identify some competencies. Let's talk about the ability to negotiate, to communicate with clients, to oral and written communication. And let's also think about persuasive advocacy and mediation and problem-solving skills and collaboration with teams. And those kinds of skills, interviewing, counseling, and negotiating, for example, project management, information literacy, those were things that one could go through the classic law school curriculum 25 years ago or so and never necessarily be in any of those, have any of those skills. Mm-hmm. And so there's a consciousness on the part of now all schools to insert those into the curriculum along the way. And now the advantage of starting anew is to be able to put those in in a kind of iterative fashion so that there's both a foundation that's required at every one of these, negotiation, interviewing, counseling, problem solving, negotiation, et cetera. And then we keep expanding upon those. So and then that does also include being able to do the certain key things in certain key fields. And that means understanding how liens work, understanding where you go in a courthouse and do this, understanding how you prepare and enter a plea bargain, et cetera. So, yes, some of those particular things, but also those core competencies that are beyond just how I think and how I write a law school exam.
I entered law school 50 years ago this September. That's kind of a daunting thought to me. And I went to a wonderful law school, the University of Texas Law School. But I graduated in that law school not ever having written a contract or drafted an agreement of any kind or written a pleading or have done any of those sort of things. The people that graduate from Iowa Law School will be receive a much different kind of training. Now, a lot's happened in the last 50 years, and law schools have all made changes. But I do listen to how Ellen is planning our curriculum, and I marvel at how many competencies our young people have compared to the zero competencies that I had when I got out of the University of Texas.
So will your faculty be focused more on teaching and less on research and publishing than at other schools?
I'd say the answer to that is yes, for a couple of reasons. We did, and when we've hired initial faculty, or what we call our founding faculty, and we've hired 3 to 4 for this coming year, and then we'll hire another 3 or 4 and another 4 or so after that. But one of the key features that we require will be really deep and serious practice experience. And part of the reason, so that's one thing we'll do. And then I think more importantly, what we do in our faculty policies, even in specifying what it is that somebody will have to do to get tenure, is that that teaching is the most important thing, and that writing can take the form of kind of engaged scholarship and not just the traditional scholarly activity.
We're speaking this hour with Ellen S. Pryor, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at UNT Dallas College of Law, and Judge Royal Ferguson, who is a retired federal district judge and dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about educating the next generation of lawyers with Professor Ellen S. Pryor, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the UNT Dallas College of Law, and the Honorable Royal Ferguson, retired U.S. District Judge and Dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I have to tell you, I was astonished to read that private school law tuitions have doubled since 2001. Public school law school tuitions have nearly tripled since 2001. First of all, why is it so expensive? And what is it that you can do to achieve your goal of keeping the UNT Dallas College of Law more affordable?
Let me try to address that first, if I could, Chris. Law schools, for example, are ranked in part on the amount of money they devote to education per student. So that pushes law schools to spend more money. And the way they get money is through tuition. Private law schools are one thing. Public law schools are another. And you might say, well, why do public law schools, why has their tuition risen so much? Is because, for example, in Texas, we've really gotten out of the business of really supporting higher education in a real meaningful way. Buildings and so forth, sort of the infrastructures is there through public support. But instruction and so forth really depends on tuition now. So as Texas has pulled back from supporting public higher education, we have had to do something to fill that gap, and we filled it through tuition. And law schools, many instances, have been encouraged to provide more bells and whistles, more support for students, because the rankings, for example, depend on it. Now we've gotten ourselves into a problem, in my view. The ABA has started keeping statistics on the average cost of law schools, both private and public, since 1985. Since 1985, public law school tuition has increased 1,000%. It went from $2,000 a year till 2012, $23,000 a year. Private law school education has increased somewhat, not like that, but it's gone from an average of $7,500 to an average of over $40,000 a year. So the amount of increase is dramatic. And, of course, then that creates problems for everybody. Right now, the average law student graduating from law school has a law school debt of over $100,000. That is a daunting problem. And you mentioned at the beginning of your show that almost half the people graduating from law school don't have jobs after 9 months. So you think of the debt burden they have and then the lack of job opportunities they have, and you can see that we are in a very difficult position. And our goal is affordability. We're a public law school, and we believe affordability is very important. I am charged with keeping our dollars in check. And so this year, our students will pay the net, every student, of $12,500 for tuition for a year, compared to about $23,000 or $24,000, the average nationally. So we're about half. And by the way, the ABA has become very concerned with this debt problem. And in their report that they issued this January, their final report, they said this: the current system of pricing and funding in legal education demands serious reengineering. This is a crisis for law schools, both public and private. And it's a crisis for our young people who are graduating. Even if they have jobs, the amount of debt they're carrying is daunting. And one of our goals is to try to address that issue by keeping our costs down. Thank gosh I've got Ellen Pryor addressing so much of the academic side and determining how we can give an excellent education at a very affordable price.
And Chris, I would add on the causation of tuition and its rise over the years, multiple factors, very complicated issues. I think the judge has certainly mentioned a couple that have been predominant. There are many others, and they're very complicated. Some have to do with the law school rankings that existing law schools feel kind of constrained by or feel that they've got to pay attention to, and those do in a kind of perverse way. Those rankings do reward spending more money on students rather than trying to be efficient, and then they also encourage a kind of lot of spending on increasing the entering GPA and LSAT scores of students by scholarships, quote unquote, which are basically tuition discounting for the students who are coming in at the higher credential level of the class. Mm-hmm. And that means that's got to be picked up by somebody. That ends up being picked up by those who are entering and paying basically full fare. So the truth is the tuition set at most law schools is being paid differentially by different students, some paying full fare, some paying a discounted fare. So those are the complexities. But you asked, too, well, what are we going to do? We don't have a magic bullet. We don't have a single answer. And we are not smarter than other people. What we have, I guess, are two advantages. We're new, and we have the wisdom and the kind of the consensus that's now evolving about the problem of both debt and what is being delivered in legal education. So we are doing our best to learn from that and apply it from the start. So just a few very simple examples. We won't do differential tuition financing. We will set our price as low as we can, consistent with providing the education we think is necessary to be excellent.
So it's like CarMax. You set the price as low as you can go, and then no one gets a discount from there. No one gets a scholarship.
Yeah. But we would like to create scholarships and raise external funds for scholarships, especially those directed at need or merit that includes need. But so we will go out and raise that. And the judge wakes up every day worrying about, I want to raise scholarships based on need and get more and more students. Because even $12,500 is too much for some people and for many of the people we want to bring. But you're exactly right. And we will not have certain legacy costs, and we won't begin to build those. And a very small thing, but it's an easy thing to illustrate, I think, a difference and connects back to your earlier question. We won't spend money on research chairs for faculty, for example. I mean, because we will have fantastic teachers and extremely high quality thinking and writing will be important for all of us. But we won't have as an independent goal raising the research profile and the famousness, if you will, of our faculty. So we will not have endowed research chairs. We won't raise money for them. We won't pay high salaries for them. That's a kind of a small thing, but it's an example of we can't be everything. And we just have chosen we will not pursue being the fully taught, full bells and whistles, national ranked law school. Because otherwise we will be back in that hunt and the inevitability of incurring a very high price structure.
And by the way, Chris, we will be an opportunity law school for many people who have not had the chance to go to law school in the past because of location or price or the emphasis on the standardized test and the GPA issues. A lot of people can be very good lawyers who have wanted to be good lawyers, but there has been an access problem, a barrier to entry. And we think by keeping our tuition as low as we can, we're going to knock away some of those barriers. It's going to be my job to raise those scholarship dollars. I think about that every day. I even obsess on it. I am worried about it. It's a great responsibility to educate these young people and to help them get through law school without a debt that is overly burdensome. And I know that. We all know that. And our goal is to do that. By the way, one last thing. The most recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek talks about the next big threat to the U.S. economy. And you know what that is? They say it's student debt. Outstanding student debt dropped $1 trillion in the third quarter of 2013. And Bloomberg Businessweek says that this burden that we're putting on our students, undergraduate, law, medicine, everywhere, is a ticking time bomb, not only for them, but for us. And some way or another, we have got to start addressing this issue of student debt. And we're just one place, but we want to do our best to make our contribution.
Many people think of a law student and they think of someone who's, you know, 22 to 25 years old and has just finished a bachelor's degree. But I guess one out of five students who apply to law schools is older. Is that right?
That's right. And the LSAC, which is called the Law School Admission Council, it administers the LSAT. They've kept data, of course, on the entire population of people who are applying to law school. And their data shows that that for those who are age 30 and older who apply to law school, the majority of those will not get into any law school to which they apply. And they apply to fewer law schools to begin with. So age is in a funny way kind of correlated with not going to law school and not being as successful in getting into law school.
And yet, it's clear to us as we look at the people who have applied to our law school, it's very clear to us that we're going to have an older student body. Mm-hmm. We're going to have an evening program. And it's very clear to us that there are a lot of people that are working right now in law firms as legal assistants. Perhaps in the city and other areas that are law-related, they want to come and get that degree and go back and use it where they are.
Or there are people—
Go ahead. But I think that's a great opportunity for us.
Or there are people who've taken longer to go through school. They haven't taken the four-year, five-year straight out. They've gone to community college. They've worked their way through a four-year college. They've done military. And so even if they haven't had a first career of great length, they've taken a while to reach the point where they're thinking about applying to law school, and they have a level of experience and insight into the world and have encountered some obstacles. And those are the students we're seeing, and those are the students we really hoped we would create a law school for.
And in fact, many of their stories are just flat inspiring, how they have overcome so many obstacles to get themselves where they are, ready to go to law school. I've read so many of these statements, and I'm just thinking, wow, these are people that are used to overcoming lots of barriers, and they can do well in law school, they can pass the bar, and they can be really fine lawyers.
How did we create the expectation in this country that anyone who graduates from law school and gets a job in the legal profession has almost a guarantee of wealth? You know, you think of Abraham Lincoln didn't necessarily get into law to become a rich man. Certainly today, there are a number of successful practicing attorneys who are not pulling down even six-figure salaries after a number of years. How did we get to where we expect law to make people rich, and how do we adjust the expectations of graduates when only a small percentage of them will earn those sort of famously large salaries?
We need to work on that. We need to actually work on that big time. Right now, much of our society's population do not have access to lawyers. Many people in the middle class, small businesses. Our Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court has been talking about that. Access is a big problem. And one of the problems is cost, that legal services have become very expensive. And we need to rethink that, in my view. And when I read the statements by the young people and older people who are applying to our law school, their mindset is different. It's pretty exceptional. They want to go back to their communities and serve their neighbors. They don't see law school as a cash cow. They see it as an opportunity for service, as a chance to make a decent income and have a decent life. But they see it so much as an opportunity for service to help their neighbors. And I am inspired by their vision.
And Chris, I think I'll push back a little bit on the characterization that law has come to be thought by most people as something like that, a ticket to wealth. When I think about the students I went to law school with 30 years ago or the 25 years worth of students I've taught, had the privilege to teach at SMU Law School, my first-year law students in torts and my upper-level students are full of students who I would not say that they're characterized by a belief that law is a kind of ticket to wealth and ease in their life. I mean, I just think that, yeah, there's that slice of individuals, I'm sure, in every law school. But I think it's more that there's a disappointment then that there seems to be fewer options or understanding when one does get out of law school about how does one find a meaningful career that one can sustain themselves economically and carry out an interesting, meaningful practice in a smaller firm, a larger firm, and not be overwhelmingly overworked, and be able to do something that's financially viable. And I think a lot of law students get out of law school and don't know how they find that practice. And that was true even before the recent downturn in the legal economy. I think students have always, who've gotten out in the bottom half of a class in law school, have often gotten out without really much experience in what lawyers do, what the range of practices are, how one sets up a practice or works with friends, what the difference is in a family lawyer and a criminal lawyer, small firms, big firms. We'd like to just educate our students from the beginning about the profession. Just what is it that lawyers do? Even in our very first semester, we'll have a class called The Profession and Practice of Law. That's partly an introduction to just these things. I want our students to come out having a sense of where do I go? What are the options for me? And where do my gifts and abilities fit? And I think the 25 years of students I've seen, again, teaching at SMU, that was the question in their minds, I think, primarily. I think it's in the questions. I think that really is more reflective of what most law students enter law school wanting to be.
We're talking about new approaches to educating young lawyers with Ellen S. Pryor, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the UNT Dallas College of Law. Also with us is retired federal judge Royal Ferguson, Dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law. We'll take your calls after the break. You can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with retired U.S. District Judge Royal Ferguson, who is Dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law, and Professor Ellen S. Pryor, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at UNT Dallas College of Law. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Chris in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, my question is related to what y'all have been talking about the last 15 minutes or so. I'm an undergrad, and some of my friends who have gone to law school and graduated have said that it's because of the high debt load, it's really only worth it if you can get hired by a big law firm paying $150,000 or more a year. Otherwise, it's just no way to pay your debt off. So I was wondering what UNT Dallas is doing to have a competitive recruitment structure in place for when they open, and how they're going to make sure that their graduates can get the jobs with, you know, the big firms downtown that the graduates of SMU and UT Austin already can get.
Our kids won't go to the big law firms downtown for jobs. I mean, we're starting out. We're a brand new law school. No brand new law school is accredited. It'll take us 2 years before we can get provisional accreditation. We can't guarantee that. The ABA says you can't guarantee it. We're going to work full-time to get it. We don't have an alumni. We don't have a track record. And the large firms downtown normally are looking for law schools with track records. So I don't believe our people, our graduates, will go to those large firms. We'll go to DA's offices, city attorney's offices. We'll send them into small firms. Some of them will be solo practitioners. Our goal, though, is to hold their debt down to such a substantial level that they won't feel that if they don't get paid $150, $150,000 a year, they'll be a failure or they can't pay their debt. That's why we're here, is to make law school affordable. And we actually, as Ellen said, our goal is to tell them there's another way, is to talk to them about other opportunities in law, about how rewarding law can be when you represent your the people in your community, your neighbors, and so forth. So we have really a different we're setting up a different path. And I'm just straightforward to say that I will go talk to those law firms and I will say that we've got exceptional people here. But it will take a while before they are in a position to hire our students. And in the meantime, we're going to still find good places for them to be where they can earn a living. They can repay the debt that we have helped them control, and they can serve their communities.
And I would also add that that big laws, we all know, is in a shrinking. I mean, their capacity to hire from every school in the top and the top slice of all the schools is shrinking because the legal market itself and big law in particular is undergoing transformative changes. So all law schools, including us, will be paying attention to those changes.
How important is it that the students you recruit are really well suited for a career in law, are really passionate about a career in law? It seems there was a time, particularly during the recession, when many people thought, well, the job market's not great. I will maybe take a graduate degree that I hadn't thought about. Some people went and applied to law school, and some of them may be thrilled with their legal careers, and others may decide that it's not really what they wanted to do, but it sounded respectable.
Yeah, I think that one of the good things about the quote, law school crisis that I think so many people hear about, the declining applications, the bad news about the profession, the lot of negative publicity about law schools in general. I think a lot of that's overwrought, and I think I disagree with pieces of it. But one benefit of it is that it has helped people, young people and people who are thinking about applying to law schools, to think more carefully about law school. I mean, it shouldn't be a default choice. It shouldn't be just, well, I don't have anything else to do, I'll go to law school. Not only for the debt reasons, but it's 3 whole years. It's a very difficult thing, and it affects your, you know, how you think about things. And there's a lot of good things about fantastic things about going to law school, but it did, I think, lapse into that kind of default choice for a lot of people. And I don't think it is anymore. On your question, I think that for us. Their interest, willingness, and passion about law is very important. It comes out on their applications in ways we look for. They're involved in or in careers in law enforcement. They're working in city code compliance. They've been criminal justice majors. They've been social workers. They're in hospital, healthcare. These are the kinds of resumes we're seeing, and they have very detailed reasons about why they're interested in law. I'm not saying every single one of them mm-hmm. does, but we see the passion in their applications, and it matters. It matters to us.
It truly does matter. And back to the question from the caller, so many of the people that are applying to our law school have a career plan. They want to be lawyers, and they know where they want to go. Mm-hmm. Some are working for lawyers. Some are Ellen said, or in law enforcement and other areas, healthcare. They know they want to go back and continue to work in those fields. In some way, having an expanded opportunity to do more. So, these people, I think, are the people that are applying to our law school have a great entrepreneurial bent to them, and it's clear that they're going to make their career through their life experiences and through their passions. We are also interviewing these young people. They can come and talk to us, and that's very helpful to us. And so many of them are doing it, which gives us a greater opportunity to understand their passion.
Yeah, actually, Chris, we thought about requiring an interview. Only one law school in the country requires an interview for admission to law school, and that's Northwestern. We called the dean there and talked to them at Northwestern about why they had instituted that. Most law schools don't offer an interview, or they're not really that interested in offering an interview. We just decided we weren't sure we could implement that well as a requirement this first year, but we've encouraged people to interview with us. And as the judge says, lots of them have. And we'll continue to look at that and maybe move towards requiring an interview.
Do you expect that the bottom 50% of your first graduating class will be as employable as the top 50%?
I don't think, at least traditionally, the bottom 50% has been as employable as the top. I mean, that's just traditionally right. Across all law schools.
But the question is almost why let a student anywhere graduate if they are not likely to be able to work with what your school has decided is an appropriate degree and they have met the requirements?
Let me say, though, that we don't – I mean, if somebody wants to be a lawyer, they've got the capacity to be a lawyer and they can be a good lawyer, they may graduate in the bottom half of the class. But let me tell you, we don't want to – we're not making that decision for them. Mm-hmm. I went to law school. I had good grades. I was on the law review. I was in the top of my class, or top part of my class, not the top, but the top part. Ellen was in the very top of her class. That's a different story. But I remember going to law school with a friend of mine who was in clearly the bottom fourth of the class. He and I ended up practicing together in El Paso. He retired before he was 50. By his legal career, he made so much money and was such a great lawyer. Such a great trial lawyer that, you know, and now he's doing a lot of public service work. But let me tell you, we don't have the ability to make that prediction that somebody in the bottom half of the class isn't going to be a success. There's a good chance they're going to be every bit of a success. Now, whether they're employable right out of law school may be a different matter. But there are people that are going to be throughout our class, throughout a lot of the classes in law school, who do exceptionally well. Joe Jamil likes to say, he barely graduated. Racehorse Haynes likes to say he was in the bottom of his class. I mean, everybody knows who those guys mm-hmm. are.
And one, I think it's a big topic, but one thing that I think bears on this bottom of the class, top of the class kind of point is that law schools traditionally have given grades along, or they're measuring essentially one thing, that the grades that people come out of law school with, their final GPA, and where they stand in the classes, basically a function of how they did on final exams in all their classes, one exam per class, you know, all through law schools. So the law school portfolio, if you will, of what a student has to show employers when they got out, pretty much grade-wise, it was their ability to take that exam. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning, we're expanding that portfolio because we are not going to have any class in which a student's only grade is based on one final exam. So we're changing. That's a whole other part of the conversation. We're changing that. So we will have grades. People will have a wider array of skills and exercises and assignments in which to practice and demonstrate ability. And so our students will have electronic portfolios of their work, their negotiation ability, their counseling skills, their written products, their drafting. And I think, again, reflecting this giant change, I think even in the legal marketplace, what the legal marketplace is starting to look for, even in the bigger firms, is are they capable? Are they competent? They're less likely to be guided as they were 20 years ago. Are they top 10%? Are they law review? So I think that it's a very interesting question. But I think we want to graduate students who all of our graduates have a set of ability, a set of experiences, and a set of documented performances and in a range of things, subject areas that really do give a full picture of who this person is and what they can do.
One of the things I've been concerned about in education is we do a great job of measuring somebody's academic intelligence. We don't do a job at all at measuring their social intelligence, measuring their initiative, their determination. I mean, how do you do that? And I can tell from the people that are looking to come to our law school, they are people with enormous determination, resiliency, grit. They've overcome so much. And, you know, the other thing is I've talked to a lot of people right now, Chris, and one lawyer stood up and said, how dare you? How dare you open up a new law school? There are no jobs. You're not even accredited. You won't even be accredited until your third year. You don't have an alumni base. How dare you do this under these circumstances? And I said, wait a minute. So you want to tell the people that are coming to our law school probably are not going to have an opportunity to go to law school if it weren't for us. So you want to tell me those people don't get to go to law school? They can be good lawyers. They can do a good job. And you're telling me and them, no, you're not going to get a chance. You're not going to get the opportunity. I say, we're going to be a good law school. We're going to meet the requirements of the ABA. I can't make any guarantees, but that is what we're going to work for every day. We are not daunted by this challenge. We are humbled by it, and we understand the responsibility that's placed upon us when people put their future in our hands. And we're going to work every day as hard as we can to make sure that they have the kind of opportunities that they deserve as people of this country, of this state, who really want to do this.
So you had a $5 million initial capital outlay from the state. How is additional fundraising going, and where are you going? To individuals, to corporations, to foundations?
I'm going everywhere. I'm talking to everybody under the sun. I'm talking to anybody that'll talk to me. I'm talking to one person. Ellen and I were talking to a group of 300 lawyers last week. We're talking to everybody. I'm traveling the state. Anybody that'll hear me, I'm talking to them. We are going to be, of course, we're state supported, but as I've said, the state of Texas really isn't going to pay for everything, and so we're going to have to be in many ways tuition based. I've got to educate people about the fact that we're here and what we're doing before I can ask them for money. I mean, I just can't walk into somebody's door and say, I need $50,000.
If you figure out how to do that, call us here at KU.
I will do it. But I've got to educate people first, and then I've got to tell them we're going to do something special, and we deserve your support. And come and meet our kids. I keep saying kids. I'm 72 years old, so, you know, 45-year-old people are kids to me. But come meet them and see how special they are, and help us support their education. I think all our money's going to scholarships, and I'm thinking every day, every way about how to raise that money for scholarships, because these young people are special. They've worked their way here, and they're ready to be good lawyers, and we're going to do everything we can to help them, especially with the financial part of it.
The Honorable Royal Ferguson is Dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law. Professor Ellen S. Pryor is Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the UNT Dallas College of Law. It's been wonderful to have you both with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.